it's really around the Rothschild family. Jacob set up this firm to last for generations to come, as you noted, to compound wealth. SpaceX is one of the most highly coveted private investments in the world. SpaceX is now also in our portfolio. We were very early in fintech. We also were exposed to the AI theme, so we had a couple of exits there as well. And over the last 18 months, we've been able to realize about 25% of our privates portfolio. When everyone was looking to divest or sell out of China last year, in the first quarter of last year, we increased our allocation to China, and that's done very well. The U.S. will always be a core market to us, but we are seeing interesting opportunities in places like Europe and elsewhere. My principal piece of advice is don't assume that the job that you start with is going to be the job that you continue on with. And it's actually very important, I think, very early in your career to be able to invest or look at very different sectors and opportunities to really find out where your passion lies.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. If this is your first time joining, I'm your host, Simon Brewer. Quick word before we start. 95% of viewers aren't subscribed, so miss out on future interviews with top business, finance, and industry leaders. To support the show and ensure we can keep sharing high-quality content, click subscribe and please drop a like. Plus, if you have any future guest ideas, do share your suggestions in the comments section below. Otherwise, thank you for watching and listening, and enjoy the show. Originally serving as a vehicle for the Rothschild family wealth, when the late and revered Jacob Rothschild took control in 1988, he transformed RIT into a publicly listed investment trust. It was rebranded as RIT Capital Partners PLC, with a mandate to preserve and grow capital across generations through a multi-asset, global and unconstrained strategy. Over time, RIT evolved into a family office-style investment trust, blending public equities, private investments, hedge funds, and uncorrelated strategies. But time is not always your friend in the investment business, and when the principal and luminary with immense reach and investment acumen retires, the skeptical voices can grow. When this is compounded by a 30% discount to its net asset value, it seemed a good time to examine RIT, one of the UK's largest investment trusts, with assets of over £4 billion. To discuss this, we welcome today Maggie Fanari, CEO of J. Rothschild Capital Management, the investment manager of RIT Capital Partners. Maggie, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Great. Thank you, Simon. Delighted to be here.
Well, unmistakable Canadian accent I hear, and we have had a conversation ahead of this, but I think you have quite a cosmopolitan background before that. Tell us a little bit about, you know, from where you herald.
Yes. So I grew up in Ontario and went to university there. I studied finance and accounting at the time. I made my way into accounting first because I actually couldn't decide if I wanted to go into finance or accounting. So I started at KPMG. I had a brilliant time there. I went into accounting. I did some corporate restructuring while I was there, but I really wanted to be an investor. I found my way to Ontario Teachers. Which is for those that don't know, it's a $260 billion Canadian pension plan, very much focused on the direct investing model for Canadian pensions. And it was a fabulous place for nearly 20 years where I was able to invest across public markets, venture and growth, private equity, and really also be very much an international investor, investing in places like emerging markets such as LATAM, Europe, North America, and Asia. And then ultimately, about more than 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to move to London, which has been great. So not only Canadian, but today a British citizen as well. I've made it home for myself. And really to help and build out our European business, the European business for Ontario Teachers as well.
Let's just pause on Ontario Teachers. We've had Joe Taylor, the CEO, on the show a couple of years ago, which was a very interesting conversation. And you appear to have had a lot of exposure through the asset classes. But what I particularly focused on when I was doing my research was that you led the high conviction equity group. high conviction means different things to different managers.
So that was just north of a $12 billion public markets portfolio for Ontario teachers. And high conviction is exactly what it means. That was a highly concentrated portfolio of less than 30 names in public stocks around the world. And that portfolio over time, there were actually a number of strategies within it, and it was really concentrated into one portfolio, high conviction, very long term, with the USP around that portfolio really being sector expertise.
And did you find, reflecting on that, and given the, you know, the immense difficulty in global equities of active outperforming passive, that it was a strategy that you felt succeeded?
Yes, at the time I was there, it succeeded and made a lot of money for Ontario teachers at the time.
Got it. So in 2019, I think you get onto the, or you are asked to join the board of RIT. So you start to see the business in operation before you took over in March 2024. Why were you tempted?
Well, actually, my association with RIT goes back well before joining the board. As I had noted earlier, Ontario Teachers is a pension plan, and at the time, I was running a special situations team with a very global mandate to go out and find opportunities in businesses where you were very much focused on capital preservation or downside protected transactions with asymmetric upside. And that's really what RIT is very much known for as well. And I kept bumping into them in my deal flow, whether it was interesting investment opportunities in North America or in Europe or in Asia. So I got to know the team quite well. And in 2019, they ultimately asked me to join the board, which I did. Its ethos is very similar to the investment philosophy I was used to at Ontario Teachers. And there was an opportunity in 2024 to come in and support the team and company at a time of management transition. And I was happy to do it.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the World Gold Council. They champion the role gold plays as a strategic asset through expert research, commentary, and insights. And it's not just your portfolio that may benefit from gold. Learn how gold mining is supporting female economic empowerment and small businesses via their new documentary series called Gold, The Journey Continues. Tap the link in the show notes to start watching. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. Just give us a sense of RIT's identity today.
So its identity today is very much in the DNA of the firm that's nearly existed for more than 40 years, as you've noted. The DNA is really around being very entrepreneurial and finding the most interesting opportunities for shareholders that aren't easily accessible. So whether that's finding the best hedge fund managers, and oftentimes that's interesting and very successful individuals who are coming out of firms and were there very early to help support their businesses as one of their first investors, and oftentimes were one of the first calls. It could mean investing in great businesses that are very hard to access, such as our recent investments in SpaceX or in Epic Systems, which is a wonderful company. It's the leading enterprise software provider for healthcare / hospitals in the United States. It could also mean finding the best hedge fund managers around the world. And that ethos and that DNA is very much still within our firm. And that's because of the flexibility we have in our investment mandate, but it's also because of the vehicle we have, which is permanent capital.
Yep. So we're going to talk about all of those and more. I'd like to start with the investment objective. Many years ago, I remember sitting in a meeting with the founder of Allbourne, who said, if you don't have a benchmark, prepare to be hit by the arrow whose name is hindsight. Now, your benchmark is CPI plus 3%, which most people who in the business thinking about preserving real wealth would accept as being legitimate. Your asset allocation is multi-asset. Do you think that's the right benchmark still?
So actually, we have two benchmarks. One is more of a capital preservation benchmark, such that we earn an appropriate risk-adjusted return for our shareholders. And the other is an equity benchmark, such that we're also capturing sufficient growth for our investors. But what that ultimately ensures is that we earn an appropriate risk-adjusted return for our investors. So we've been able to grow our NAV over the last decade by more than 100%. And we've done that with lower risk than equity markets.
So I sit on a couple of investment committees. I was on one this week where Mercer's made a very credible presentation on optimizing the mix for the objective of the mandate. How do you think about that mix given those benchmarks, and how flexible do you want to be?
So we want to be flexible, and that flexibility affords us, along with the permanence of our capital, affords us to be able to stay invested long term in our highest conviction opportunities. So that means that we don't have to sell them should something change in the markets. But it also gives us the flexibility to be able to be a bit more tactical around our portfolio and to think about the different types of risks in the portfolio that might develop when the market changes, and then we can decide whether we want to mitigate those risks. So that could mean that we look to increase our allocation to uncorrelated strategies, such as our hedge fund program. It may mean that we choose to be more bullish in equities and add to our equities exposure, or at times we might choose a more neutral positioning like we have today. And it's really as we look over this year, where we've seen a lot of volatility, in the first quarter of the year, our uncorrelated strategies, which is really designed to provide a steady return for investors. So what does that include? It includes things like credit, market neutral funds, macro funds, actually looked out to outperform the our equity benchmark at the time. It's just designed to provide a steady level of returns for investors.
So in talking to some people ahead of this interview who know you in the vehicle, one was Mark Wallace, who's the senior managing director over at Rothschild, the other Rothschild, Rothschild & Co., where I'm a senior advisor. And he said there's a lot to like about having privates and publics in one evergreen vehicle. How do you think about capital allocation between the publics and the privates?
So it does wax and wane. I would say a couple of years ago, we probably had more privates exposure than we've had historically. So we've been actively looking to reduce our privates exposure, really anywhere between 25 to 30% of our portfolio. And fundamentally, I believe that that gives us the right flexibility, but also captures the appropriate amount of growth for our investors. And when we think about private assets, that part of our portfolio is really designed to capture growth.
So in reading your materials, you refer to the unrivaled network that you have. Now, a cynic would say, well, Jacob Rothschild's had an unrivaled network. Why do you think you still have an unrivaled network?
So it's a great point. I mean, it's really around the Rothschild family. Jacob set up this firm to last for generations to come, as you noted, to compound wealth for generations. And as a result of that, the DNA of the team is very much that same ethos of being really good partners to our partners. And people really want to work for us. The brand opens any door for us. SpaceX is one of the most highly coveted private investments in the world. That was a company I knew very well from my time at Ontario Teachers, And when I came to RIT, SpaceX is now also in our portfolio. We have the opportunity with our existing fund partners who are massively oversubscribed. Every time they want to raise a new fund, they are significantly oversubscribed. Yet we always get our allocations with our partners, and we've been investing with new partners as well. But it's really that ethos around the brand and the heritage and the way that we engage with our partners, which is really a two-way street.
So it's pausing on the privates, because you obviously make these direct investments in private companies. We know there's a lot of congestion, to be euphemistic, about the world of PE. Is your preference to go direct, or do you blend it with, you know, a number of private equity managers who you think have the edge?
We have very much a partnership-driven approach, so we really look to invest alongside our partners. So we want to invest with the partners who see the best deals, are able to pick the best deals, and invest in the best companies through a cycle. And then they show us some of their best opportunities, and we invest alongside them. And this year, as you noted, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion around DPI, and also that private equity exits have been muted. We've actually had the opposite view. We've had one of the best years in terms of realizations this year. We've realized close to 5% of our balance sheet in privates, nearly $175 million in realizations. And it's really been across three themes. So we were very early in fintech. So we've had a couple of exits there. We also were exposed to the AI theme. So we had a couple of exits there as well. So we've been quite fortunate from that perspective. And over the last 18 months, we've been able to realize about 25% of our privates portfolio.
Got it.
At or above valuations to our carrying values.
Okay. Well, again, one of the other folks we talked to, and you know him, Nick Lawson, who's the founder of Ocean Wall, very impressive boutique investment bank, said you have some great China assets, you have some great space assets. And let's just talk about the Chinese or the China assets in a world that has pretty bifurcated views about whether you can or can't, or should or shouldn't, or, you know, will or won't. Tell us a little bit about your China exposure.
So we've been invested in China for a very long time. I mean, we were very early to think about globalization. So for us, we've been invested in China for more than 15 years. We tend to do that through specialist managers, and that in the region, such that we don't need to open offices and put boots on the ground. So we identify, and we do it in a very concentrated way. In our view, we identify two of the best managers where we can also have a strong two-way dialogue with those managers. And we look to invest and benefit from their insights. And then we also look to make some direct investments on our balance sheet. And with respect to China, yes, when everyone was looking to divest or sell out of China last year, in the first quarter of last year, we increased our allocation to China, and that's done very well. That's done very well for us this year.
So let's pause on that emerging market allocation, which I see from your most recent report is circa 9%. Mm-hmm. I think at Christmas, we had the EM as an asset category trading at a 50-year low to the S&P 500. And those of us of a certain persuasion were saying, hang on a second, you know, this creates opportunity. Of the nine, how is the nine made up? The 9%, how much is China and how much is other parts of the emerging market universe?
So the majority of it is in China.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what, when we think about, because you have this fantastic playing field, potentially, which is also, you know, creates dilemmas because there is opportunity everywhere. Talk me through what would get exposure to Vietnam, Indonesia, Singapore, you know, on into the committee, and then the steps that would lead to making an allocation that makes sense.
So it's interesting you say Vietnam. I mean, these are the conversations that we're having in our investment committees. And if we think about markets like Vietnam, the way that we would think about our exposure more broadly in EM, maybe that we don't look at Vietnam standalone, but we think about that more broadly as part of our EM exposure. And in that case, we would really look to think about who are the top EM managers around the world, who's very specialized in that area. And then we would look to have conversations with them. The good news is over our more than close to 40 year history, we have been in places like Brazil, like EM. So we do have longstanding partners within our network that we're easily able to call up and say, look, can we invest alongside you?
So as I went through your research and papers, I was nodding quite a lot. And then I came to this comment about credit. And you, maybe not you, but it was written credit is less correlated to equity. And you've obviously already mentioned that you have exposure to credit. We just did an episode with Hugh Van Steenis and Olivia Wyman on the kind of the credit boom, the private credit boom. And I'm there going, you know what? When really difficult times occur, credit behaves like equity with less liquidity. And so I just want to tease you out why you think it sort of is helping. It's sort of in the diversifying camp of the portfolio.
So I will clarify. Our exposure is to public credit, and we have not actually gone into private credit. In part, going back to your question, we can get wonderful returns from our credit opportunities without the illiquidity that we've seen through private credit markets. And actually, as I noted earlier in the earlier part of this year and continuation of this year, our credit managers have been able to deliver uncorrelated returns to the markets.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm excited to announce that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, known as LSEG. At the heart of the global economy, LSEG provides data, analytics, and infrastructure that connects investors, businesses, and economies. LSEG is where ideas meet capital, enabling sustainable growth and opportunity. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more. Schroders Capital is the private markets division of Schroders. Combining the experience of specialized local teams with the scale, rigor, and resources of a global institutional platform. Schroders Capital provides its clients with global access to differentiated and specialized strategies encompassing all private markets asset classes, from private equity to real estate, infrastructure, and the broad universe of private debt and credit alternatives. This approach enables Schroders Capital to access opportunities and investments that are often difficult to find elsewhere, while also having the broad capabilities and perspectives needed to build holistic solutions and deliver tailored outcomes across private markets for both institutional and wealth clients. Discover more at schroderscapital.com. Remember, capital is at risk with investing.
The other area that, again, I paused on, this is a sterling-denominated vehicle. Yes. 53% of your post-hedged currency exposure is in sterling. You pointed out to me the other day that you do hedge back. 32% circa is still US dollars. Now, we know that ultimately no currency, with the exception perhaps of the Swiss franc, has held its value. And right now, the collective finances of Western governments are more powerless than ever. So we should expect continued currency erosion. And the US dollar seems to have an administration as well that would quite favor that. Is that carrying actually quite a lot of risk in a world where the Norwegian krona offers fantastic value versus purchasing power, and the dollar looks pretty precarious?
So we're not looking to take an active bet with our currency exposure. So we do hedge half our exposure, and that's roughly been consistent for several years now, Simon. So in some years, like this year, we will have a negative translation effect to our portfolio, and then in other years it'll be neutral to positive. So actually, over the last few years, our currency exposure with respect to or currency impact to our portfolio has more or less been neutral. So it's important to take a longer term perspective around how we think about hedging our portfolio. That being said, another active discussion in our investment committee is now we do have to think about if we find a really fantastic investment in the US, how do we want to think about the potential currency impact around that? And what we have been doing, and there have been other opportunities that have really become available over the last 12 months, are the US will always be a core market to us, but we are seeing interesting opportunities in places like Europe and elsewhere. So we've been diversifying further away from the US. We've also increased our gold exposure in addition to maintaining our views on the currency, which is to hedge roughly half of our exposure.
Okay. So one of the other developments in the investment industry has been the co-investment theme. And I was chatting to Sean Capstick, who's the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, but in a previous world had dealt with you at Ontario Teachers. And he said you were very keen and quite early in really trying to cherry pick some of the really interesting ideas a manager might have and then invest on that or with that idea. Has that been something you've carried on that you do actively? Is this the destination of travel for both you, do you think, and parts of the industry?
So I can't speak to parts of the industry, but I think that partnership approach and being able to have that right dynamic with your partners is definitely very core to the way that I've invested for more than 20 years, but also to core to the DNA of how RIT has been investing almost since inception as well.
Yes, I would say from my observations, it is happening more. I've seen it, you know, Campion Capital, you know, who we know very well. And I've seen it, you know, Lansdowne have a new vehicle as well, where that's a likely way in which they expect it to expand. Let's talk about performance, which of course will bring us to the discount. You've got great long-term numbers, but that's the benefit of having some fantastic earlier years as well. We all know the performance, you know, game. And yet not alone in the UK market, and we are expecting to have Blackman on at some point. He's agreed in principle, Pershing Square trades at a 30% discount. You're at a 30% discount. How do you reflect on that, firstly? And secondly, how is the board thinking about everything that's in your power going forward to improve it?
Well, it is a top priority for both the management team and the board. You know, the immediate thing to do is to buy back our shares. So we have In over the last two-year period, bought back more than 10% of our portfolio. We continue to do that, but also to performance. Performance comes into play. This year, actually, we just reported our results earlier this week. Year to date, we're at a 7.5% return. All three of our investment pillars, or said differently, our public markets investments, our private market investments, and our credit and absolute returning strategies are all generating very positive returns. And part of the discount has been impacted by private investments. But what we've been able to demonstrate is that not only do we have positive returns because of some of the recent rounds that have taken place around some interesting companies like OpenAI and so on, but we've also had very strong realizations. So if I think about, are we in the best quadrant we could be for investors, which is positive returns along with positive realizations, that's exactly where we are. And we've been able to demonstrate that over the last 18 months, but a good amount of narrowing the discount is linked to performance, but it's also linked to our ability to engage with shareholders. And we've made significant investment over the last 18 months, really to engage with our shareholders through being a lot more transparent in how we present information and get information into the hands of our shareholders. We have a very rigorous process around how we value our private assets, and we do that twice a year. We have a number of internal checks and balances. That's on our website. That's in our audited financial statements so everyone can openly see what our process is in and around that. And what we've actually found over time is over the last decade, we've had generally a 23% markup to our private company valuations. And then more recently, this year, that number has been cumulatively somewhere north of 100%.
So I did actually go and look at not just your most recent monthly fact sheets, but then I went back several years and I can actually see the disclosures, you know, have improved. And for somebody who kind of, you know, looks at these things, you know, quite a lot, it was, you know, it was very comprehensible and, you know, and accessible. The thing that you've mentioned, which does make you very different, is this family capital that is particularly permanent, or at least would appear to be. Just tell us a little bit about, refresh us, is it 20% of the NAV and what that means to you?
So it's more than 23% of the NAV. Okay. It is a substantial portion of family wealth, in addition to, alongside many of our other shareholders as well.
And then that begs the question of your other investors. I mean, this has been a largely UK audience, I imagine, over the years for all sorts of reasons. That was the investment trusts. There's a lot of global capital. We've had Burs Weinstein coming in, you know, after some of these investment trusts. We've featured Seraphim and IP Group and talked about their discounts, etc. Who else can buy it but isn't that you would like to see on your register?
So who else we'd love to see on our register is a multi-asset class vehicle. It's very much focused on the long term with the idea of building a portfolio that's resilient across various market cycles, Simon. So other long-term investors that this vehicle is ideally suited for would really be endowments, very long-term minded investors who are looking for a similar return profile that we offer.
We haven't spoken about the team. I know you brought a number of people in as well to help you. Just give us a sense of, you know, how that team's changed and you know, how you deploy your troops.
So we have had change on the team. We also have the new people that I've been able to bring onto the business. And I do think, you know, if I take a step back, one of my core priorities is always to be on the lookout for great talent and to be able to bring that into the business. So we've been able to bring on a couple of people, including by former employer and a number of very large institutions to join our firm and complement a team in many cases who have been there collectively for more than a decade working together. The team's job day in and day out is to ensure that we understand the nature of the investments that we have in our portfolio, but also to scour the world globally to find the next exciting investment for our investors that isn't easily accessible to everyone else.
You talked earlier on a little bit about the ethos of RIT being downside protection. Just talk a little bit about tail protection risk, about strategies that you either put on or don't put on beyond asset allocation to think about that.
So we do. I mean, we have other hedging strategies. So at times we will think about tail hedging in our portfolio. If we have a view around certain market risks, we'll also change our allocation as we did in the earlier part of this year to be more neutral on our equities allocation at the start of this year. We will think about if we've got too much exposure, if we're too concentrated to any one name in our portfolio, we will find ways to think about how we can reduce those exposures. So it's a very active conversation. And we really want to ensure that, especially that bottom up, you've selected the right assets, but top down that you've constructed the right portfolio that truly delivers what we want to deliver for our investors, which is the best risk-adjusted returns.
And because you've seen the investment industry for a reasonable amount of time, you cross the playing field of assets. How might the industry look in 5+ years? How different might it look from today's?
I think what we're already seeing today is the growth of the alternatives business, and you know, more choice for private for private assets, and that's been ongoing for some period of time, and I think that trend will generally continue. Private credit has been ongoing for a period of time, and I think that trend will continue. But really, in the private space, you can see that part of the market will grow.
And the other thing that we talk about with a lot of our guests is culture. Many of us who have observed RIT over the years would have said that it's probably quite established, maybe not Victoria, but it's quite an established, one would have thought, male-dominated culture that had the signature of a principal born in a different era. You've come in, very different. What have you wanted to do with the culture of the organization, and how have you done it?
Well, the culture of the organization, it's a great culture. So if I think about the values of our firm, I mean, it started with a very entrepreneurial founder and someone who is very forward looking, and being entrepreneurial is very much core to our values. The other is just that exceptional laser focus on performance. And that's exactly how we're set up as a team. And then the other one is really, when I think about values, is just collaboration and communication across the team. You never want to develop silos within your organization, and we're small enough and lean enough to ensure that doesn't happen, and actually that there are true synergies across the organization.
Got it. And on your LinkedIn bio and commentary, you said, "At RIT, my priorities are drive returns." We discussed that. Enhance transparency. We discussed that. And drive investor engagement. And we've sort of touched on that, but I'd like to just understand a little bit more. What are the tools that are allowing you to improve investor engagement?
It's really our outreach. So we've really brought in some great people in our investor relations and comms department. We've also retained an external firm to support us in external shareholder engagement through Kadarn. And it's really our focus and intent to be as visible and as accessible as possible. In about a month's time, we have a Section 793 call with retail investors. These are all things that we had not previously done before. And we've also been able to bring on some great investors onto our shareholder base as well. But it's really just being very disciplined and very consistent in our outreach.
Well, it's interesting because by the time this episode is released in October, you will have attended the Money Maze Allocator Summit at the London Stock Exchange over 2 days. And in fact, you're kindly joining one of the panels to talk about some of these key issues about how we think about engaging with managers and the discussions, both in hiring and the difficult discussions in firing. So we will not talk about that because maybe we will repurpose that part of that particular interview. Just tell me who's not on the chessboard that you would like to be.
So, I mean, what we've looked to do is really provide information in the hands of our investors to ensure that they understand our investment proposition, they understand what we own, and why we offer things that they otherwise can't easily get through more passive instruments. In terms of an RIT shareholder, as we also own private assets, we really look to people who have very much a long-term perspective. And as we're both global and diversified, RIT is very complementary to most people's portfolios. So whether that's long-term retail investors, endowments, or other institutions that are really looking to see returns compound over a long period of time in investment opportunities that they might not otherwise be able to get access to through more passive instruments.
What's your most important daily habit?
My most important daily habit is reading the news.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you, what are the most important, if there could be only one news source you would read every day, which would it be?
The FT.
Okay. We've got lots of young people listening to the show. We've sponsored, 10 university finance societies. I'm sure you're asked this as you travel, but what's your principal piece of advice for young folks thinking about the investment world and joining it?
My principal piece of advice is don't assume that the job that you start with is going to be the job that you continue on with. And it's actually very important, I think, very early in your career to be able to invest or look at very different sectors and opportunities to really find out where your passion lies.
Right. And connected with that, not necessarily, but often, because we are lucky enough to interview lots of very successful people, most of them will have had the wind in their face at various times. How have you dealt with adversity when it struck you?
You know, it's really making progress one day at a time, and just tackling every issue, but just kind of being grateful for the progress you make every day tackling that headwind.
And did you have a particularly important mentor on your journey? And if so, what did they provide you with?
I've had many, many great mentors over time. And the best piece of advice I've actually received is to trust your instincts. And that's very much carried me through my career.
So I'm going to summarize, because many of us who've been in the investment world, you know, understand that for all wealth, really, you know, preserving your real purchasing power and growing it is essential. And it is difficult when you are dealing with, you know, currencies that whose governments are the architects of their continual erosion. And that may be, in my opinion, something that gets profoundly more difficult in the environment as governments deal with debtedness and they want to be reelected, which leads them down the path of least resistance, handing on problems to the next generation. This is a vehicle that is surviving, intends to survive, with an extraordinarily important cohort of, you know, of family wealth, doing multi-assets, with, as you've explained, the ability to be both flexible in asset allocation, to use the network that is, you know, in part yours, but, you know, legacy connections that give you opportunities and access, which is very valuable. And today we have this, you know, you can view it as very, you know, very annoying 30% discount. And there might be a lot of people out here who are listening and watching going, wow, that's an interesting opportunity. I, for one, invest globally. I do not, at this point in time, own RIT, but I am very intrigued. So we really look forward to speaking to you today. And thank you so much for coming and giving us your time.
Great. Thank you, Simon.